Chapter 46. It took the launch vehicle engineers just under 24 hours to convert the rocket's payload into a weapon of mass horror. Like surgeons conducting a transplant operation, the engineering team carefully removed several sections of the outer payload fairing and delved into the inner workings of the mock satellite. Fake components, built to resemble communication transponders, were removed and replaced with small electric pumps, which would drive the aerosol system. Lines and fittings were attached to the phony solar panels, which would open in flight to spread the rejuvenated virus, disseminating it as a fine mist across the California sky. Working in protective clean room bunny suits, the technicians performed a final test on the dispensing system, ensuring it was fully functional for the short rocket flight. The final step of the operation was then reached, inserting the Chimera virus into the payload vehicle. The canisters from Incheon containing the freeze-dried germs were carefully mounted to the satellite frame, and steel braided lines from the hydrogenation tanks were connected to the aerosol system. When activated, a software-controlled program would vacuum mix the powdered substance with purified water, then transfer the live fluid through the vaporizer and out into the atmosphere. With the deadly cocktail loaded aboard, the payload fairing was reassembled around the satellite. Propellant explosives were inserted at key points inside the fairing to blast the payload doors away at the appointed moment during flight. When the final section of the nose cone housing was sealed into place, the tired engineering team congratulated one another briefly and then staggered towards the crew's quarters. A few precious hours of sleep was all they could ask for before it would be time to start the final launch countdown. Without publicly raising the color-coded threat advisory system, the Department of Homeland Security quietly issued an elevated Marine Port and Airport security alert. Stepped-up screening and random searches were performed on all aircraft and vessels originating from an Asian locale, with special inspections for biological and chemical agents. At Vice President Sandecker's insistence, the Coast Guard was ordered to stop, board and search all Japanese or Korean-flagged inbound ships with a fully armed security contingent. All available Coast Guard cutters were put to sea along the West Coast, concentrated around the commercial hubs of Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. In San Francisco, Rudy Gunn coordinated NUMA's interdiction support with the local Coast Guard commandant. When the research vessel Blue Gill arrived from Monterey, Gunn immediately assigned her picket duty 10 miles off the Golden Gate Bridge. He then jumped up to Seattle, where he directed local NUMA resources in support of coastal screening and enlisted the aid of the Canadian Coast Guard in Vancouver to search all British Columbia-bound ships. Dirk and Summer flew to San Diego, where they were welcomed by the city's trademark 72-degree balmy weather. Taking a short cab ride from San Diego International Airport's Lindbergh Field to Shelter Island, it took them only a few minutes to locate the Deep Endeavor tied up at the end of a large municipal dock. As they approached the ship, Dirk noticed that an odd-shaped submersible painted a metallic burnt orange sat on the vessel's stern deck. "Well, if it isn't the prisoners of Zenda," Jack Dahlgren called from the bridge wing upon spotting the twosome boarding the ship. Dirk's close friend hopped down a stairwell and met them at the head of the gangway. "Heard you two enjoyed a seaside tour of the Korean Peninsula," Dahlgren laughed as he shook Dirk's hand firmly, then gave Summer a hug.
"Yes, but we somehow missed the Michelin-rated attractions," Summer grinned back.
"Nah, wait, that DMZ tour was pretty stimulating," Dirk said, feigning seriousness. Turning to Dahlgren, he asked, "You and the crew ready to do a little search and seizure work?"
"Yep. The Coast Guard team joined us an hour ago, so we're ready to shove off at any time."
"Good. Let's get after it, then." Dahlgren escorted Dirk and Summer up to the bridge, where they were greeted by Leo Delgado and Captain Birch, then introduced to a uniformed Coast Guard sea marshal named Ames.
"What's our intercept procedure, Lieutenant?" Dirk asked, noting the insignia on Ames' uniform.
"Call me Bill," replied Ames. A studious man with cropped blonde hair, Ames took his duty seriously, but hated unnecessary formality.
We'll be assisting the regional Coast Guard vessels as a backup when and if commercial traffic gets particularly heavy. Otherwise, we'll be assigned to ad hoc survey and reconnaissance. Under legislative rule, we can intercept and board all inbound commercial vessels up to 12 miles offshore. As NUMA's Coast Guard representative, I will lead all boardings and searches with my team, but will be assisted by several of your crewmen who have undergone a brief training session. What are the chances we could actually locate a weapons cache or bomb hidden on a large container ship? Summer wondered. Better than you might think, Ames replied. As you know, we work closely with the Customs Department under the direction of the Homeland Security Department. Our customs agents are located at foreign ports around the globe and are on site to inspect and seal all cargo containers before the goods are allowed to ship. Upon arriving in U.S. ports, customs agents verify that the containers have not been opened or tampered with before acceptance into this country. The Coast Guard provides an advance check of the ship and containers before they have a chance to reach port. There's plenty of places on a ship outside of the cargo containers where somebody could hide a bomb, Dahlgren stated. That's a more difficult problem, but it's where the dogs come into play, Ames replied, nodding his head towards the far end of the bridge. Dirk noticed for the first time that a pair of yellow Labrador retrievers were tied to a bulkhead stanchion and lay prone asleep on the deck. Summer had already made her way over to the dogs and began scratching them contentedly behind the ears. The dogs are trained to sniff out a variety of explosive compounds commonly used in bomb manufacture. Best of all, they can run through a ship in quick order. If a biological bomb is being smuggled in on a container ship, there's a good chance those boys could sniff out the explosives component of it. That's what we're looking for, Dirk said. So we'll be working off of San Diego? No, Ames replied, shaking his head. There's only minimal commercial traffic that moves through San Diego, and the regional Coast Guard vessels are more than adequate to handle the volume. We've been ordered to patrol a quadrant southwest of the Port of Los Angeles in support of the L.A. Long Beach Coast Guard Marine Safety Group. Once on site, we'll coordinate local positioning and boarding through Icarus. Icarus? Dahlgren asked. Our all-seeing eye in the sky on the project, Dirk said with a knowing smile. As the Deep Endeavor chugged towards the Pacific, cruising past Coronado Island and a Navy aircraft carrier inbound from the Indian Ocean, Dirk and Summer went aft and studied the strange submersible that faintly resembled a steroid-augmented earthworm. The bullet-shaped vessel was dotted with a series of bladed propulsion units mounted irregularly about the main body like glued-on heat pumps. Strutted beneath the front of its bullet nose stood a giant coring device that stood 10 feet long, protruding upwards like a unicorn's horn. Bathed in its garish orange-red metallic hue, the submersible reminded them of a giant insect from a 1950s horror film. What's the story on this contraption? Summer asked of Dahlgren. Your father didn't tell you about the Badger? It's a prototype that he authorized. That's why we were here in San Diego. Some of our engineers have been working on a joint venture with Scripps Institute to develop this hot rod. It's a deep water corer designed to gather sediment samples from the seabed. The scientific community is anxious to gather sediment and organism samples around volcanic hydrothermal vents, many of which are located 10,000 feet or deeper. What's with all the propulsion units? Dirk asked. To get to the bottom in a hurry. She's a real speed buggy. Rather than waiting for gravity to pull her to the seafloor, she has a hydrogen fuel cell power plant that allows her to submerge at speed to the bottom. She allows you to descend, take a core sample, and then pop back to the surface without twiddling your thumbs all day. Less time spent diving and surfacing means more core samples for the geologists to pick through. And the boys at Scripps were actually willing to trust you behind the wheel? Summer asked with a laugh. They didn't ask how many speeding tickets I have on land, so I didn't feel compelled to tell them, Dahlgren replied with mock innocence. Little do they know, Dirk grinned, that they just loaned their new Harley-Davidson to Evel Knievel. The Deep Endeavor steamed up the California coast for 3 hours before turning out to sea just before darkness. Dirk stood on the bridge watching the ship's progress on a colored navigation map displayed on an overhead monitor. As the coastline fell away behind them, he observed the island of San Clemente scroll up on the map to the west of their aligned path. He studied the map for a moment, then turned to Ames, who stood nearby examining a radar scope. "I thought your interdictions were restricted to no more than 12 miles from the coast. We're headed by San Clemente Island, which is over 50 miles from the mainland." "For normal coastal duty, we recognize the 12-mile limit from the mainland. The Channel Islands are technically a part of California, however, so legally we can operate from the islands as an origination point. For this mission, we have been given temporary authorization to expand our normal interdiction zone, with the Channel Islands as a baseline. We'll set a position about 10 miles west of Santa Catalina as our base monitoring position." 2 hours later, they cruised beyond the large island of Catalina, and the engines slowed as they neared their station point. At a slow crawl, the Deep Endeavor began patrolling a large north-to-south loop west of the island, using the ship's radar as surveillance eyes. A sprinkling of pleasure craft and fishing boats was all the radar detected, along with a Coast Guard cutter on patrol nearby to the north. "We are positioned well south of the main shipping lane to L.A. and not likely to catch much night traffic in this quadrant," Ames said. "We'll get tossed into the fray in the morning, when Icarus shows up for work. In the meantime, I suggest we take shifts and get some sleep." Dirk took the hint and walked out onto the bridge wing, inhaling a deep breath of sea air. The night was still and damp, and the seas almost as flat as a pancake. As he stood in the darkness, his mind tumbled over his meeting with Kang and the less than implicit threat that the mogul had delivered to Summer in him. Another week, and the South Korean assembly vote would be history, and the legal authorities could pursue Kang with full fury. That's all they needed. A week without incident. As he stared at the sea, a chilled gust of wind suddenly whisked his face, then fell away again just as suddenly, leaving a tranquil and seeming calm.